Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're diving into a really fascinating copyright case. It's all about a song we all know and love, Santa Claus is Coming to Town.
Oh yeah, a classic.
Specifically, we're looking at Baldwin v. EMI Feist Catalog, Inc. We've got some great source material here, excerpts from a detailed case analysis, and also some standard legal briefs.
Good stuff to dig into.
Great. So our mission today is basically to unpack the complexities of copyright termination rights under the Copyright Act, naturally, and we're using this case as our guide, especially for those of you maybe studying law.
It's a perfect case study for that, really.
The big question we'll be exploring is, well, how did the songwriter's heirs try to get the rights back to this iconic tune, and what were the pretty significant legal hurdles they actually had to overcome.
Exactly. In this case, it's such a perfect example of how copyright law, especially when you're dealing with these like really old creative works with a long history, multiple agreements, it can get surprisingly intricate.
Yeah, definitely not straightforward.
Not at all. And what's fascinating is seeing how fundamental contract law principles, you know, just basic contract stuff, intersects with these very specific copyright statutes.
Okay, so let's start where the story begins. Back in 1934, J. Fred Coots and Haven Gillespie, they wrote Santa Claus is Coming to Town.
Mm-hmm.
And pretty quickly, they sold the initial copyright rights to EMI's predecessor, which was Leo Feist, Inc. So that's the foundation, right? The original deal.
Right. That initial transfer that gave Leo Feist and then later EMI the rights to, you know, reproduce, distribute, perform the song, the usual bundle. But copyright law, it has these provisions built in for authors or their heirs to potentially reclaim those rights down the line.
Okay. And that brings us to 1951. So decades later, Coots entered into another agreement with EMI. This time it involved his renewal rights to the song's copyright. Now, for those of us who aren't, you know, deep in copyright law, what exactly are renewal rights and why were they so important here?
Okay, so think of renewal rights like a second bite at the apple for the copyright holder. Under the copyright law at the time, this is important. The initial copyright term was followed by a renewal term.
Okay.
The author, or sometimes their heirs, had the right to secure this renewal term. It could potentially extend their control over the work for a significantly longer period. So this 1951 agreement, it essentially assigned that future renewal term to EMI.
Ah, so EMI was looking ahead.
Exactly. They were locking in their rights for the long haul, basically ensuring they kept control even after the initial term expired.
Okay, makes sense. Fast forward again now to 1981. This is where things get really interesting, and the legal wrangling really kicks off. Coots actually attempted to terminate that 1951 agreement.
Right, using provisions in the Copyright Act.
Yes. But, and this is a crucial twist, in the very same year, he also signed a brand new agreement with EMI. Talk about a plot twist.
It is such a critical point. This 1981 contract, it was incredibly broad. The language stated that Coots transferred all rights and interests whatsoever in the song to EMI.
Wow, whatsoever.
Yeah, whatsoever. This wasn't just like tweaking the old deal. It was a comprehensive, total transfer that explicitly included that extended renewal term we just talked about.
Right.
So even as he was, you know, trying to terminate the old agreement, he was simultaneously creating a whole new one.
And here's another really critical detail, one with major legal consequences. Coots's 1981 termination notice, the one aimed at ending the 1951 agreement. It was never officially recorded with the Copyright Office.
Oof.
Yeah. That sounds like a pretty significant oversight. What are the implications of not recording a document like that?
Well, in copyright law, particularly when you're talking about termination rights, there are often these very specific procedural steps you have to follow meticulously.
Okay.
Recording a termination notice with the Copyright Office, it serves as a public record. It puts everyone officially on notice.
Yeah.
Failure to do that, it can render the notice legally invalid.
So useless, basically.
Pretty much. And that's exactly what happened with Coots' 1981 attempt. It's just a powerful reminder that in law, sometimes the process, the procedure, matters just as much as the intent behind it.
So the 1981 termination attempt fizzled out because of this procedural screw-up. Now, let's jump ahead again. Coots passed away, and his heirs, Gloria Baldwin, Patricia Bergdahl, and Christine Pomatessa, they took up the cause.
Right, the next generation.
They made their own attempts to reclaim the copyright, sending multiple termination notices to EMI. Let's see, in 2004, 2007, 2012. It's like the baton of legal action was passed down, wasn't it?
Exactly. The heirs were exercising rights that the Copyright Act specifically provides to authors and their families, the right to potentially terminate these copyright transfers after a certain period. And these later notices, these were the ones that ultimately led to the actual lawsuit, Baldwin v. EMI.
Okay. And initially, when the case went to the district court, the ruling actually sided with EMI, didn't it?
It did, yeah.
Can you break down the court's reasoning at that stage? What was their take on all these different agreements flying around?
So the district court's decision really hinged on their interpretation of which agreement was the controlling one. They believed that EMI's rights in the song stemmed primarily from the 1951 Renewal Rights Agreement.
The older one.
The older one, exactly. And because that 1951 agreement was signed before January 1st, 1978, that's a key date in copyright law, the district court reasoned that it fell under Section 304 of the Copyright Act.
Okay.
And Section 304 has different rules for termination than Section 203, which applies to agreements made after that date. So they essentially viewed the 1981 agreement as not fundamentally changing the rights EMI already had from 1951.
So they sort of dismissed the 81 agreement?
In a way, yeah. They concluded that EMI's rights would just continue under the old rules until 2029.
But that wasn't the final curtain call, was it? The heirs appealed. They took it up to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, and that court actually overturned the lower court's ruling. That's a pretty significant reversal.
Huge reversal, yeah.
What changed? What did the Second Circuit see differently?
It was absolutely crucial. The Second Circuit's central finding was that the district court had, well, basically gotten it wrong about which agreement was the source of EMI's rights. The appellate court determined that EMI's rights actually derived from the 1981 agreement, not the 1951 one.
Ah, the newer one.
The newer one. And this is a really key distinction because, like we touched on, agreements made before and after January 1st, 1978, they're subject to different sections of the Copyright Act. Different rules, different timelines for termination.
Okay, so what was it about that 1981 agreement that made the Second Circuit say, no, this is the one that matters? Why did it supersede the 1951 agreement in their view?
What's fascinating here is the sheer breadth of the language in that 81 agreement. Remember, it wasn't just a minor tweak or an expansion. It explicitly stated a transfer of all rights and interests whatsoever to EMI.
That phrase again.
The Second Circuit interpreted this as a complete and total assignment. They called it a clean break from the 1951 agreement.
Okay, a fresh start.
Essentially, yes. The 1981 agreement created a brand new grant of copyright, effectively replacing the previous one. And crucially, because this new grant happened in 1981, after that January 1st, 78 cutoff,
it fell under Section 203.
Exactly. It became subject to the termination provisions of Section 203, which applies to post-78 grants and allows for termination 35 years after the grant was made. So the timing, the date of that agreement was absolutely critical.
That makes a lot of sense. So once the 1981 agreement was pegged as the controlling one and therefore subject to Section 203, the focus then shifted to those termination notices sent by the heirs, right? The ones in 2004, 2007, 2012. Which of those did the Second Circuit deem valid?
Precisely. The court then had to examine the timing and the specifics of each of those notices. Did they comply with Section 203's requirements? And they ultimately identified the 2007 termination notice as the valid one.
Okay, the 2007 one. Let's zero in on the timing here because that seems key. The 1981 agreement was signed in December of that year. How did that signing date affect the 35-year window for termination under Section 203? And why was the 2007 notice the one that fit perfectly?
Okay, so because the 81 agreement was signed in December 1981, if you add 35 years, that brings you to December 2016. That's when the window for termination under Section 203 technically opened.
Got it.
Now, the 2007 notice, it specifically stated an effective termination date of December 15th, 2016. That date fell squarely within the statutory window allowed by Section 203. You have to give notice before the 35 years are up, but you specify an effective date within a five-year period, starting 35 years after the grant.
So they timed it just right.
They timed it perfectly. It anticipated that termination window correctly, which is why the Second Circuit said, yep, this one's valid.
And what about the other notices? The one from 2004 and the one from 2012, why weren't they the deciding factors? Was 2004 just too early?
Yeah, the 2004 notice was likely considered premature. It probably aimed for a termination date that was too far before that 35-year window opened in 2016.
Mm-hmm.
As for the 2012 notice, which I think aimed for termination in 2021,
right,
it wasn't necessary. Once the Second Circuit decided the 2007 notice was valid and effective as of December 15, 2016, The later notice just became legally superfluous, you know.
Redundant.
Exactly. The 2007 notice had already done the job legally.
Okay. Going back to the procedural side for a moment, you mentioned how important that is. We remember Kootz's own 1981 termination attempt failed because he didn't record it. How did the heirs' 2007 notice fare on that front? Did they learn from that earlier mistake?
Well, our sources don't spell out the entire filing history step by step, but the fact that the Second Circuit found the 2007 notice valid strongly implies that, yes, they did comply with all the necessary procedural hoops.
So presumably served on EMI properly and recorded.
And recorded with the Copyright Office, crucially. It really just hammers home the point we made earlier. Attention to detail following these seemingly bureaucratic steps is absolutely vital in copyright termination cases. You can't skip them.
Right. Now, there's another really interesting and maybe a bit nuanced aspect of Section 203 that came into play here, something called the right of publication exclusion. Can you break down what that is and how it factored into the Second Circuit's decision?
Yeah, this is a key exception tucked within Section 203. The law basically says that authors cannot terminate a grant under this section if that specific grant included the right of publication.
Okay, so you can't terminate if the deal included publication rights. Why is that?
Well, the thinking behind it, the rationale, is mainly aimed at previously unpublished works. For a work that's never been seen before, that initial grant of the right to publish it is considered a really significant event. So Congress kind of carved out this exception for those situations.
That makes sense for an unpublished work. But Santa Claus is Coming to Town. I mean, it was clearly published way back in 1934. It's one of the most famous songs ever. So how did this right of publication thing become relevant here?
That's the crucial point, and it's a bit counterintuitive. In this case, the 1981 agreement, the one the Second Circuit said was controlling it, did not actually include a grant of the right of publication.
Why not?
Because EMI already possessed those publication rights. They get them way back in the original 1934 agreement. The song had been published, sold, played on the radio for decades.
Right, they didn't need to get that right again.
Exactly. So since the right of publication wasn't part of the new grant made in the 1981 agreement, the termination was permissible under Section 203. The exclusion didn't apply.
Wow. So if the 1981 agreement had explicitly mentioned granting the right of publication again, even though EMI already had it, the outcome could have been totally different.
Quite possibly, yes. It really underscores how precisely these agreements need to be drafted and then later interpreted. Had the 1981 agreement been worded differently, perhaps interpreted as re-granting the right of publication, even if it seemed redundant, EMI could have made a strong argument that, hey, this grant included publication rights, so Section 203 termination is blocked by the exclusion. It shows how specific wording and the scope of what's being granted are absolutely paramount. They can have huge unforeseen consequences years later.
That's a really sharp point. Okay, so let's bring all these threads together.
Right.
What was the final ruling from the Second Circuit, and what are the really key takeaways here? Especially for our listeners who might be studying law, what are the big lessons this case teaches us about copyright?
Okay, so the final ruling. The Second Circuit definitively reversed the district court. No ambiguity there. They declare the 2007 termination notice valid, meaning that EMI's rights to Santa Claus is Coming to Town under that 1981 agreement were officially terminated as of December 15th, 2016. And that effectively returned the copyright control, or at least the U.S. rights covered by the termination, back to J. Fred Kootz's heirs.
Wow. After all that time.
After all that time. Now, for law students, this case is packed with incredibly valuable insights into copyright termination. Firstly, it hammers home the critical importance of accurately identifying the operative agreement. Is it pre-78 Section 304 or post-78 Section 203? Because they have fundamentally different rules and timelines.
Right. Step one.
Step one. Secondly, that right of publication exclusion in Section 203. It seems niche, but it can have broad implications and requires really careful analysis of what exactly was granted in the relevant agreement.
Don't overlook the details.
Definitely not. Thirdly, the case vividly illustrates that strict adherence to procedural requirements like properly recording termination notices is absolutely non-negotiable. Mess that up and your whole case can collapse.
Like what happened to Kootz himself in 81.
Exactly. And finally, it demonstrates that even in areas like entertainment law, which might seem straightforward sometimes, you can encounter incredibly complex issues. You need meticulous contractual interpretation, meticulous statutory interpretation. It's a great reminder that copyright law is dynamic, it's intricate, and the details matter. a lot.
So to really boil it down then, this deep dive into Baldwin v. EMI, it shows us that the journey of even a beloved song like Santa Claus Has Come Into Town through copyright law is anything but simple, right? It's just a compelling real-world example of how contractual history, statutory deadlines, they all constantly interact and can lead to these really significant legal battles over ownership.
Absolutely. And it really, really highlights the long-term implications of negotiating and then maybe renegotiating copyright agreement. It makes you think, you know, what kind of thorough due diligence should both creators and the companies acquiring rights undertake? How can they try and preemptively avoid these kinds of future, potentially very costly, disputes?
Yeah, what could they have done differently back in 81 or even 51?
Precisely. This case, centered around such a cherished, enduring holiday song, it just underscores the lasting relevance and, frankly, the often surprising complexities of copyright law in our cultural landscape. It really makes you consider, doesn't it? How different might the outcome have been with just slightly different wording in that 1981 agreement? Or if Coots' original termination notice had been properly recorded back then? It definitely gives you a lot to think about regarding the enduring power and the real intricacies of intellectual property law.